Savvy regards to the staff of student teachers at NEMATA. This is the main professor with the audio for the first unit in Block 102 of Course 2, which is, of course, Gaian cosmology. So I'd like to begin by bringing your attention to the outstanding premise of Gaian cosmology, which I have otherwise or elsewhere designated as the rule of semblance or the principle of semblance. Namely, the universe is designed to operate in a way that conforms to your capacity to perceive it. You invent the Gaian cosmos every time you apply your mind to questioning the phenomena of nature or to question the phenomena of the psyche. So nature and the psyche are complementary and interfacing aspects of the cosmos, and whenever you investigate either of those, you bring this principle to mind. If you're going to look at the workings of nature, if you're going to look at the sun, the moon, the planets, if you're going to look further at the stars and the astrophysical realm, you do so bearing in mind that everything that is physically and materially operating out there, all around you, is designed to reveal itself and to operate in a way that conforms to your capacity to perceive it. Or I would even add, your innate capacity to receive and perceive the very dynamics of the great event in which you find yourself located. So you can never really be lost when you begin with this principle. You can never lose your way as long as you return continually to the assertion of this simple principle. And as I say, this single statement is the sum and essence of tantric cosmology, Gaian cosmology being identical with that term. Now, as I know here in the text on the first unit for Block 102, the greater part of the material here presents previously unpublished material from the course, which was given as 40 lessons in Santa Fe, New Mexico, initially, and then was revised, I think, into what? I don't know, 22 or 26 lessons, I can never remember. And this material was not even released on metahistory.org. So it comes through here for the first time. I've revised it, I've edited it, I've added some commentary. To my surprise, most of it stands up pretty well today and can be developed consistent with the framework of Sophianic cosmology. So, I also make the point at the beginning of, in this first unit of the four, that the glaring difference between Gaian cosmology and conventional physics can be said to come down to the term of irrepresentable. Now, this difficult and unfortunate word, irrepresentable, was, to my knowledge, first formally introduced by Schrödinger. by the time that Schrödinger introduced this concept, which was probably in the early 30s, the irrepresentable character of modern physics had already been very well established, unfortunately. And that is due to the hijacking and the diversion of the development of physics, the physics of the natural world, due to the subversion that occurred around 120 years ago, during the time of James Maxwell and Faraday, and also Poincaré. Now, there's a book that I have in the library of the Turton's Archives, which is called Psyche and Substance, Essays on Homeopathy in the Light of Jungian Psychology. And the author is Edward C. Whitmont. I remember that I purchased this book with high expectations that it would provide me with a way to base Jungian archetypal psychology in the natural setting. Or to put it another way, it would provide me with some parameters for interfacing Jungian archetypal psychology, in which I was deeply immersed in my 20s, with ecology and psychoecology and the alchemical Gaian concept of nature that I was intending to formulate, you see. And what I found was not exactly what I was looking for. In fact, I found Whitmont's book to be distracting and disappointing. However, I will quote from a paragraph on page 83 of his book, where Whitmont is discussing the realm of modern physics as it relates to Jungian psychology. So what actually are you looking at here? What actually are you talking about, dude? Well, you're talking about the nature-psyche interface. You know, where is psyche? Where is the human psyche in nature? Where are the processes of your psyche, memory, imagination, perception? Where are they in nature? How can they be compared to natural processes? And on the other hand, where is nature in the psyche? Where are the processes of nature that you recognize as photosynthesis, the production of nitrogen, the carbon cycle, the formation of clouds? Where do all of these processes in the habitat where the human animal lives find themselves in the psyche of the human animal? These are the great, great questions. In my mind, these are the questions that are worth asking, and the questions that will really and truly yield a Gaian tantric physics. Now, this quest for Gaian tantric physics in its modern phase began in the period of the Romantics, from the late 1700s into the 1800s. And it defined itself at that time in what was called Naturphilosophie, nature philosophy, you see? So today, what you inherit, what I myself inherited, and I share with you this inheritance, is the striving of the Romantics to achieve a formulation of nature philosophy, as Goethe did. And in that formulation, nature and psyche will be seen and encountered as integral parts of the same dynamic, There is a unitary dynamic of what happens in your psyche, which appears to be confined to your subjective bubble of awareness alone, but is not in reality so confined, and what happens in the natural environment around you. So the problem that comes up from the 120 years ago or better, the problem that comes up with the subversion and deviation of physics into mathematical nonsense is very clearly indicated in this passage in the book by Whitmont, Psyche and Substance. So let me see if I can run you quickly through this passage. What Whitmont tries to do is he tries to explain the Jungian concept of synchronicity. Now, Jung actually wrote an entire book, it's actually a short book, a monograph, on synchronicity, in collaboration with another prominent nuclear theoretical physicist of the time, Wolfgang Pauli. So Pauli and Jung collaborated on this book on synchronicity, and Jung's focus in that case was on the Yi Qing. And what Jung wanted to explain was how the Yi Qing oracle, which is performed either through using three coins or through using 50 yarrow stalks in the traditional method, how the physical ritual of the Yi Qing performed in this way, a physical act like any other act, like having a cup of tea or driving to the local grocery, could possibly be interactive and simultaneous with events in the human psyche, which it proves to be. So if you actually work with the Yi Qing oracle, as I did for many, many years, you will find, yes, indeed, that the ritual performance of this oracle, which is an event in the natural world, like water dripping or putting the shirt on your back, it's an event, an action in the natural world, interfaces dynamically and meaningfully with an event in the psyche. So Jung tries to explain this. And Whitmont says, in summarizing his concept, Jung admits that synchronicity represents a highly abstract, not readily visualized entity. He points out that since the meaningful or intelligent behavior of low forms of life, which have no brain or even lifeless bodies, fall within its scope, it forces us to abandon the concept of psyche as associated with the brain. Rather, we seem to deal with a formal or formative factor of meaning independent of any brain activity, which expresses itself equally through lifeless things, body and psyche. Okay, stop here. You can already see the problem with this language and how Whitmont himself is not clear on what he's talking about. How can you say that the psyche is not lifeless? The psyche is as alive as a squirrel or an elephant or a gray whale or an amoeba. So there's already the confusion in the mind of the commentator about the intelligence of life and the presumed intelligent behavior of lifeless things. Continuing, this again is in complete agreement with the conclusion of nuclear physics as expressed by Schrödinger, that form, not substance, is to be the fundamental concept underlying the dynamism of matter. We are encountering here the dynamic of what medieval philosophers called the causae formalis, the ordering power of an inherent form, intent, or entelechy. Thus we come to understand the psychosomatic interplay as but one instance of synchronicity, the expression of a formative or meaningful element, rather than as a linear mechanical cause and effect interrelation. I make no apology for subjecting you to this language. I want to show you how delusional, distracting, confused, and mumbly-jumbly the thinking of people such as Whitmont can be. And you find this mumbly-jumbly sound, namby-pamby kind of genre of thinking written all over the work of C.G. Jung, as well as in the work of the designated pioneers of modern physics such as Erwin Schrödinger. Final paragraph. I'm getting to the point here. Remember, Schrödinger is the culprit here, and the key word is irrepresentable. Final paragraph. Jung goes further to add that the fact of the, quote, absolute knowledge that characterizes the synchronicity phenomena, a knowledge which includes future and space-distant events and which is not transmitted by any sense organ, suggests to us the existence of a per se meaning of a transcendental nature that, quote, exists in a psychically relative space and time, that is to say, in an irrepresentable space-time continuum, end quote, and end of paragraph. So this last phrase about an irrepresentable space-time continuum is Whitmont quoting Jung, and that is just exactly the problem with Jung that I encountered when I began to write the course and that I solved in the writing of the course. And what is that fundamental problem of Jung which comes up in the forefront of any consideration of inventing the Gaian cosmos? Well, it's very simple. It's amazingly simple and obvious. It's painfully obvious that C.G. Jung cannot locate where the processes of the psyche happen. And so, it seems to him that they must happen in the same fictional dimension referred by Planck, Einstein, Schrödinger, Heisenberg, Bohm, you name them. It seems to Jung that the operations of your psyche as a human animal must happen in that same continuum of space-time described by the mathematics of these theoretical physicists, as they call themselves. And what I pointed out, what I endeavored to develop in the course, was a completely different proposition. I said, no, 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 I ain't going to rehab with these dudes. My mama says I'm fine, and I ain't got the time. I ain't going to rehab to be programmed by Schrödinger or Jung. I'm going to look and reflect on what happens in my psyche, which is the same thing that happens in your psyche. You have concepts, you have percepts, you have memories, you have imagination, and you have a fifth element. And you have all of these events which can be defined as the productions of your psyche, the workings of your psyche, and where do they happen? Where do they happen? Where do you think they happen? The general assumption is they happen in inner space. And inner space is the irrepresentable space-time continuum. You see where I'm getting at here? You see where I'm going with this? You see how the refutation of this fictive, delusional concept has to be confronted at the very first stage of creating, inventing the cosmology that corresponds to how you actually live in the cosmos and how the cosmos lives in you. Can you see it? So I say now, just as I said in the course that many years ago, that the productions of your mind and the activities of your psyche, including memory, fantasy, ideation, are events in nature, just as much as the budding of the leaves of a tree, just as much as the freezing and melting of water, just as much as the clouds blowing across the mountains. The thoughts in your mind are events that happen in the natural habitat. They do not happen in some indefinable, irrepresentable place. They happen in the place where you live. Your thoughts are activities of nature, as much as the activities of nature that you see externally around you. And it was my opinion, it was my inspiration, the total force of my inspiration, which led me to undertake this massive project of the course back around 1984 and work on it for 3 or 4 years, producing a initial version, an original version, and then a revised version. It was the powerful, powerful realization that the psyche operates in nature just as nature operates in the psyche that inspired me to do that, you see. And it's that same inspiration that brings me back to this material today. So I'm counting on the fact that you won't be too bored you won't find it tedious that I have reproduced this material at this time. You'll see, of course, that the language in which I've written it is addressed to a group of students who met with me once a week in order to discuss this material. So I'm using the word continually, we. Who is the we here? The we is myself and the students who undertook that course back in the mid-80s. All right, so far so good. Now, my intention in this audio talk, which is posted in the first unit of Block 102, the first of the four, is to give you an overview of what you're going to find in the entire block. So as I wrote there, if you choose to undertake this adventure, you are required from the outset, from this moment on, to give up all interest in the following. Are you ready for this? Pull up your knickers, sit back, and enjoy. Black holes, particle physics, theoretical physics, special and general relativity, quantum theory, unified field theory, string theory, atomic theory, tensor mathematics, curvature of space-time, quasars, pulsars, neutron stars, Big Bang scenario, indeterminacy, gravity waves, photons, gluons, and quarks, quantum strangeness, quantum entanglement, E=mc², Bell's theorem, CERN particle acceleration, Schrödinger's cat, meow, meow, wave-particle duality, the double-slit experiment, the Higgs boson, the guard particle, dark matter, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, I'm uncertain about what that is, the holographic universe, the nebular hypothesis, accretion disk theory of planetary formation, current model of star formation, differential rotation, the exploding sun, gravity according to Newtonian theory and Einstein. And that's just a partial list. Just let it all blow away in the wind. None of that will ever get you to the living cosmos. None of it will ever get you to the core of the mystery of the nature-psyche interface. None of it. And none of it is accurate. None of it is valid. It's not veracious. It cannot be experimentally verified. The moment that someone tells you that he or she is a theoretical physicist, you know that you're looking at a con. There's no such thing as theoretical physics. Physics is the actual description of how things work. It's not a hypothetical supposition about how they might work based on complex mathematical permutations, which at the end of the day have absolutely nothing to do with nature. By the way, while I'm on this rant, I might add that you may have heard, and you certainly very for damn sure have heard, quote, "Mathematics is the language of nature," end quote. Wrong. Wrong. Mathematics is not the language of nature. Mathematics is a human construction that arises from the attempt to formulate the order of nature in a way that can be grasped by the human mind. Mathematics is not the language of nature. And so, all of this that I've listed here in this paragraph can be discarded. And isn't that a great relief? I can tell you, you can save years of your life from a futile expenditure of your time on the internet listening to people who are explaining dark matter, unified field theory, curvature of space-time, string theory, etc., etc., etc. Ad nauseam. You never have to waste your time on any of this. And do not be intimidated by anyone that wants to make you look ignorant, uninformed, or foolish, because you don't give a rat's ass about any of it. By the way, I think I saw today, it's what, the 9th of October, I think I saw that Stephen Hawking just died. And isn't that appropriate and fitting for me to be talking to you about these matters today? So you see on the page for Unit 1, I've provided a link to Ken Wheeler, who is a genial gent on the internet, fluent in Pali and Greek, who really goes after the insanity and delusion of modern physics and really takes it down quite well. So I thought I'd introduce you to him. And I've made some notes there on some of the points that he makes, which I won't go into here. But basically, you can trust this dude. I trust this dude. I haven't found anything that he says so far that is not right on. And of course, he evokes wisdom with high praise in this vid. And of course, wisdom is Sophia. And she, the mother, gives you the mother wisdom. She imparts the mother wisdom to the child. She gives you her mind. I add a little note there on Henri Poincaré, because Poincaré is the first individual on record, as far as I know, to have defined the so-called three-body problem. And the three-body problem, as I've noted in Not in This Image and elsewhere, closely parallels the trimorphic protonoia of Sophianic physics, the Earth-Moon-Sun system. Also, Ken Wheeler uses the term natura naturans. I wouldn't be surprised if he's not also fluent in Latin as well as Greek. And I can point you, and I do point you, to a passage in Notnus Image where I use that same Latin language, quoting Sir John Woodruff. The goddess Ovaya turns into the earth, morphing into the physical elements of the solid planet, secreting the solid, fluid, and aerial elements of the atmosphere from her own substance, the mystery light. Quote Woodruff. This primal power, Adya Shakti, as object of worship, is the great mother, Magna Mater, of all natural things, Natura Naturans, and is nature itself, Natura Naturata. End quote. So you see, Natura Naturans is the full, live, vivid, real, experiential, existential plenum of all of nature in its immediate spontaneity. That's Natura Naturans, as cited by Ken Wheeler. It's a distinction that goes back to medieval philosophy. I think it goes back to Boethius. Boethius. Around 400 AD, I'm guessing. And so forth and so on. Ken Wheeler just knocks down the quantum entirely, and quantum is a shekel. So if nature cannot be measured in quanta, then you can't charge for it in shekels, period. That's all you have to know about quantum theory. And also, I note that on debunking modern physics, I recommend you look into the work of my colleague and friend Robert Otey, and I include there a short 5-minute vid from him summarizing where he's at currently. Robert's done a tremendous amount of work in deconstructing and debunking Einstein and quantum theory and string theory and gravitational theory and so on and so forth. So there you have it. I'm going to move on now to the second, third, and fourth units and quickly go over them to orient you to the material I've provided. Title of Unit 2 is Living in 4D. So you might be intrigued or even delighted, who knows, to adopt this jargon that we live in 4D. When you meet someone, you don't meet them in 3D, which would be the case if you went into a movie theater and put on those glasses and watched the 3D special effects illusion. No, you live in the reality of 4D, which is three dimensions of space integrated into a gestalt with one dimension of time. That's what it means to live in 4D. So I reproduce here the opening paragraphs of the course in which I refer to a set of novels called The Alexandria Quartet, which I read many, many times beginning at the age of 16 and had a tremendous influence upon me. And also have you note that at those points where a topic or individual I cited at the time is no longer valid or no longer veracious, I insert the hash sign, hashtag, and I also insert the paragraph sign to show where I have added some commentary. So, of course, the concept of space-time is a purely mathematical one, introduced by Hermann Minkowski, who was a pioneer in what is called non-Euclidean geometry, along with the Russian Lobachevsky. And so Minkowski and Lobachevsky were active at the time that Albert Einstein appeared on the scene. And so as the narrative goes, as the invented story goes, Einstein drew from Minkowski, who announced that space and time separately have vanished into the mirror shadows, and only a sort of combination of the two preserves any reality, end quote. Yeah, well, that's what Minkowski said based on creating a mathematical formula for space-time. So once he had a mathematical formula, which he constructed, and then he looked at this formula and said, I define this formula as a description of space-time, then he turned back to the natural world and he said, well, space and time, you know, they vanish. You know, this is the typical thinking of the theoretical physicist or the mathematical physicist. Okay? And you'll note there that I run down Minkowski and what he was actually saying, and then I go into the primary image that I used to develop a system of tantric or Gaian tantric physics, and that is the Yab-Yum, or the Mithuna of tantric cosmology. So you see how I present that. And then you come to a point where you find the paragraph sign, that squiggle. It's not actually a paragraph sign, but it's something that I use. Where I wrote, my view of Einstein was radically changed when I encountered Einstein's theory of relativity from an epistemological viewpoint, written by Ernst Cassirer. The moment of that development, a major step in my intellectual life, would have been in the spring of 1972 in Kittitas, Washington. I had a job at a grain silo that required me to operate a huge vacuum tube to empty loaded trucks. There's plenty of free time between deliveries. I consider myself hugely fortunate to have made that breakthrough at that time. Well, what was that breakthrough? Well, quite simply this. I'm reading and rereading and rereading Einstein's theory of relativity from an epistemological viewpoint and trying to get to the point. And finally, I come to this paragraph, which is totally fucking unparalleled in anything that I had read. And I've been trying to understand relativity, special and general relativity, and the curvature of space-time, and all those Einsteinian concepts already for quite a few years. But I never heard anybody come out and say, what Cassirer said. And what he said was, hey, look, there are 10 tensor equations that Einstein is said to have formulated. Certain people today would tell you that it was actually his wife who came up with these equations. But they're attributed to Einstein. And these 10 tensor equations of special and general relativity are said to be of a high degree of mathematical elegance and sophistication. Ooh, ooh, ooh. No one like you and me couldn't get anywhere near these formulas. But Cassirer says these formulas do not describe the operations of nature. They do not describe the dynamics of the events to be witnessed in space and time, either the immediate realm of phenomenon connected with the Earth or the more remote realms of phenomena in the stars, in the interstellar and intergalactic regions. No. These formulas only describe certain necessities of measurement with rods and clocks. That is the standard term. Measurement with rods and clocks. That is to say, measurement with measuring rods, like a measuring tape, and clocks. So Einstein's formulas of general and special relativity are not about the actual physical dynamics of the universe that you can observe. They're about the conventions of measurement using distances and magnitudes of time and space. And when I got that, I mean, can you imagine what that did? That was like being kicked in the face by a mule. That was a really big wake-up call. And that revelation coming from Ernst Cassirer uniquely really allowed me to say, well, fuck it. I mean, I'm not going to spend any more of my precious intellectual talent on trying to understand Albert Einstein, because now I know that his theories and his formulas have nothing to do, they do not reach or satisfy a veracious description of the cosmos. And so I moved on happily from that point on. So that was a great moment and I'm happy to record that moment, and I talked a lot about that back in those days when I was doing the course with those students in Santa Fe. Now, when I sent out my prospectus for the course, you see the word prospectus here, it was a document that I wrote in Xerox. I think it consisted of some 10, 12 pages. And it explained to those students who might subscribe and pay to attend a 40-week course with me exactly what they were going to get. And I established the objective of the course, the aim of the course, on one single concept, which I called the concept of incompletion. And I said that the fundamental truth of ancient alchemy and hermetics comes from a perception of those genuine adepts, a perception that the world event, the cosmos, whatever you want to call it, is incomplete. So you're living in a system that is incomplete. The natural world is incomplete. The overarching cosmos beyond the earth, reaching out to the furthest reaches of cosmic manifestation, is incomplete. So I used the term incompletion. And I said that the purpose of this course will be to look at the manner in which the human witness and participant in the cosmos is an agent in the completion of the cosmos, in the completion of the cosmic order. Now, for that premise, that was my working hypothesis, my opening line. Now, for that premise to be explored, you have to go along a course of investigation that includes the human being in the world event as a physical agent. And what I pointed out was that the supreme hypocrisy of modern science is to include the human being in its world picture. Yes, it's human beings who take measurements of distance and measurements of time in order to develop physical laws. But the human being is included as a physical agent, but it is devoid of any physical effect upon the world process. That is the supreme hypocrisy of physics. According to the assumption of physics, the only value that you or any other human animal has ever had, the only efficacy you've ever had in the total dynamics of the world event, is to go around with measuring rods and clocks and take down numbers and record numbers and then juggle with these numbers and make formulas out of them and then presume from those formulas made from these measurements that you are capturing how the dynamics of the universe works. And in all of that, you, the human creature, has no physical effect. So I coined the term a returning effect. And I took that term, by the way, from Paracelsus, because as far as I know, Paracelsus was the first one, at least on record, to specifically assert that the human creature living in the cosmos has a returning effect upon nature. So these notions, incompletion, the returning effect, the interactivity of the human agent and the cosmos at large, were the founding concepts of the Course. And I return you to those fundamental propositions in these original units. Okay? Better said, perhaps I invite you, if you are so disposed, to go revisit, for you it will be to visit for the first time, but for me to revisit this foundational material. So there you have the primary syntax for the Course, and you have in capital letters the one of the leading propositions that I worked with at that time. We experience ourselves as existing in space with time present to us in such a way that space and time are given simultaneously in one and the same gestalt. And that is what I call a simplific statement of description. So then, moving on to Unit 3, I have gone further into that syntax. So what are the three dimensions of space? So here I explain that normally, conventionally, you are taught that the three dimensions of space are what? Height, up and down. Breadth, referring to the right and to the left. The expanses on each side of you is the breadth, as in the breadth of your talent, the breadth of your knowledge. And finally, depth, which is what you are actually in. What is in front of you is depth. What is behind you, depth in spatial terms. Every time you move, every time you cross the room, not to mention crossing a continent or crossing the street or crossing a continent, you move in depth. You move into the depth. Now, normally we are taught that these are the three dimensions of space. But in presenting the Course way back when, I endeavored to show that that is not the case at all, that there is an entirely different descriptive syntax available to describe what you are experiencing in space. What is space? And I broke it down in the way that you see here in the text for this unit. And I recall that we had quite a good time, and we really enjoyed investigating the validity of this new descriptive syntax. Namely, it is more accurate to describe height, breadth, and depth as the three inertial frames of one modality of space, enclosing space. Well, everyone knows what enclosing space is. I wasn't demanding the students at that time to theorize or to speculate or to strain their minds by forming any kind of proposition of some irrepresentable reality. It's all totally representable and presentable. What does representable mean? It means to repeat a presentation of something. So the world event, as you find yourself located in it, presents certain features, and it continually represents them when you go back and look again and look again and investigate and look again. It continually repeats the presentation of those features. And so I point out that space is of three kinds. And the first kind of space is simply the space that you're in. It's all around you. It's up above, below, to the right and left, front and back. Therefore, that space which encloses you, which appears to be vacant and empty space, well, that already has these frames of height, breadth, and depth. They belong exclusively to D1 of space, enclosing space, or S1 as I call it. So S1 is enclosing space, but that's not the end of it. What other kind of space do you encounter? Well, there I am in my den, in my workroom, and I'm enclosed in the space of the room, which is obviously empty. I'm allowed to walk around it, but what encloses it? Well, right over here, there's a wall. Beneath my feet, there is a surface. There is a surface of the ceiling, and these are all surfaces. So what are these surfaces around me? Well, they are the features, the presentation and representation of S2. Surface space. And surface space is really critical. For instance, on the wall to my left, there's enough surface space for me to display the 17 bands in 5 ranks of the Thunderbird formation. You see? It's all there in that surface space. How much surface space is there in the windshield of your car? How much surface space is there in your dining room table? In the counter of the bathroom where you stand and brush your teeth? How much surface space is there occupied by the mirror in which you look as you brush your teeth? The planar continuum of surfaces is in itself another dimension of space, S2. And that idea is wonderfully novel and wonderfully enticing and intriguing, and I find it also to be so to this day. Finally, we can ask, well, is there any other kind of space besides space that encloses me and space that I can touch with my hand, surfaces that I can touch, surfaces that I can scan with my eyes? Was there any other kind of space? Well, I used the example at that time of a brick. And I held up a brick. I also used the example of an apple. Let's go to the apple. I'll hold up an apple and say, look, here's an apple. Now the apple is sitting on my hand, which is freely located in an open space. I'm not in a tiny box. I'm in a room which provides me with enough of S1, enclosing space, that I can move around and I can stand here with an apple in the palm of my hand. Okay. Palm of my hand is surface space. So the object of the apple is on the surface space of my hand, because my entire body is defined by surface space. And the apple itself is defined by its surface, the red peel of the apple. Now, you don't call it a peel while it's on the apple, do you? Well, just stop for a moment and consider this red apple in my hand. I'm holding out to this red apple. And I'm saying, look, this red apple is bounded by surface space. Now, if you peel off the covering of the red apple, you'll have in your hand a peeling, which is sort of like the residue or the coat or the skin of surface space, because surface space is just always a layer, you see? But as long as the peel is on the apple, let's go back and put the peel back on the apple, it's still a space. It's the space of the surface of the apple that encloses the space enclosed, S3, which is the space bounded by the surfaces of physical objects which themselves are located in the vacancy of S1, space enclosed. And so when I use this analogy to students at the time, I don't know if I actually got out a knife and cut the apple open, I might have, but I said, well, hey, look, you want to know what's inside the apple? Do you really? Do you want to know what's inside the red skin of the apple, which we call the peel when you remove it from the apple? Like a residue of S2, surface space. But you want to know, you want to really get inside the apple and look at the materiality, the material mass enclosed by S2. Cut open the apple. I hold it up to you now in two hands. Did you get inside the materiality of the apple? No. What you have is you have created another space, which is the circular surface of the apple divided into two parts. There is no way to get into space enclosed, S3. You can't go there unless you're already there. You see that? Same with a brick. I say, here I have in front of me a brick, or right over here I have a big chunk of granite. Probably weighs about 10 pounds. It's a big chunk of granite, a big cube of granite. I'm looking at it, touch it with my fingers. Oh, yeah. There's the surface space of the granite. It's pretty smooth. It's a little rough here. It's a rough surface, smooth surface. There are edges, but the edges still do not give boundary to surface space. They just give a contour, a shape to it, but it has no boundary. So, looking at this chunk of granite, I'm saying, well, I'd really like to know what's inside there, so I'm going to get a chisel and cut it open. What happens? I can't get inside. You see that? I can't get into S3, space enclosed, because even if I chisel away a part of this block of granite, if I split it open, I've still got another surface. And then I break that open, and there's another surface. And so it goes. And isn't it rather wonderful to conceive of it all in that way? I have to say that to this day, I find it novel and entertaining. And so I sum up all of this in one single proposition. We experience ourselves as located physically in enclosing space, on surface space, and outside space enclosed. You are always outside of space enclosed. Can you see that? Except in the case of your own body, where you have the experience of being in some way located in your own skin. That is to say, within the topological boundaries of the surface of your body. So finally, moving on from that short unit, which I think is self-explanatory for the most part, come to the fourth and final unit in Block 102, which I call the pan-sensorial continuum. And the purpose of this unit is to simply explore what you have as your ensemble of instruments for perceiving and detecting the workings of the cosmos. And that ensemble, or instrument panel, if you want to call it that, is configured in such a way that you find it on the surface of your body. So all of your senses and sense organs are accessories, features, custom designed to work on the surface of your body. So they are aspects of S2, surface space, which is the boundless topological planar extension of space. Within your skin, within your body, you have mass, this mysterious element of mass. And of course, mass comes up in the course in part 3. Now, I just want to point out in concluding this introductory talk that the revised version of the course was broken into 3 parts of 7 lessons each. The first part, in its totality, was dedicated to space, the second part to time, and the third part to matter. So, in the original course material, of which I don't know how much I would reprise or revisit or rework in these courses, but in that original course material, running to 500 pages, well, there was a lot of explanation of, well, explanation is not the right word. There was a lot of direction regarding how to just experience what is normally present to you through your sense of space, your sense of time, and your 5 senses. So the purpose of Unit 4 is simply to introduce the 5 senses, which I call the pan-sensorial continuum. And what you see there is a breakdown of them in a manner that gives you a sense of how they are designed. They're designed in a particular way, and the sense organs which provide the impressions for hearing, sight, smell, taste, and touch are installed in the surface of your body in a particular way, and the way that the installations are different. The way that they have been designed to operate can be distinguished according to the way they are installed. Do you get that logic? So, for instance, what do we notice just in looking at these 5 senses? Well, how are they designed into the form of the human witness of the cosmos? Well, all but touch have their corresponding organs located in the head. Is that not correct? Hearing, sight, smell, taste. Eyes for sight, ears for hearing, nose for smell, and tongue for taste. The organ for touch is the skin. You can touch with your tongue. You can touch with your nose. But according to the design, the organ for touch is the skin, which is distributed all over the body. Therefore, touch is not localized in the head. So what? Well, this becomes, over the course of time, in the Gayan Tantric investigation, a matter that is more and more mysterious and more wonderful and revealing. All you have to do is contemplate it and stay in your senses. So this short unit, number 4, gives you an overview of the 5 senses, the pan-sensorial continuum. And that's it. It concludes on this note that you can make a correlation between hearing and space, between sight and light or observation, and between materiality and the 3 other senses of smell, taste, and touch. So, there is a natural division of the concept senses, hearing and sight, and the contact senses, smell, taste, and touch. And on that primary syntax, you can go a long, long way into Gayan Tantric physics. So I leave it on that note and invite you to enjoy this material, not for its intellectual content, which is novel and original, but for the way that it enhances your perception of reality as you know it, and for the way that you can actually verify it through your mind and senses in their natural and immediate functions.